consent. Only with your consent. Only with your consent. Today on KPR Presents, sex education in an internet age, and why we need to focus more on teaching kids no means no, and yes means yes. I'm Kay McIntyre. On today's program, we'll visit with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He's a Lawrence psychologist who specializes in teens and young adults and the co-author of the popular weekly column, Double Take. Dr. Crenshaw's latest project is Consent-Based Sex Education, Parenting Teens in an Internet Age. In just a minute, we'll visit with Dr. Wes, but first, let's set the mood with the Sex Consent Anthem by Jack Howard and Dean Dobbs.
I am sitting in the club. I feel it's not hot enough until you walk in. It's like, oh my God. Then again, I don't believe in God. I believe in you, and that's the truth. I want to get close to you and get all up inside your space.
Whoa there, what are you doing? You don't even know this woman. She's a fine young thing. She don't need grooming. She's a human being. She's got a brain and remembers everything you say, which reminds me, hi, sorry to talk about you. Anyway, Jabby got things to do.
Women?
No, that's what I'm trying to say. Let's let this out to the right extent.
This guy wants you, but only with your consent. Only with your consent. Only with your consent. Only with your consent.
If you've got the time to make those kind of moves, then make it right. What have you got to lose?
Let's lay things down, clear and stable. This ain't no game, this ain't no fable.
This is a story about two individuals. Communications grew, they became a sort of ritual. One of them decided to change their mind.
And just to clarify, that's completely fine.
Cause no means no.
Yes, no.
Yes, no.
Yes, I get it now.
It works only with your consent. Only with your consent. Only with your consent. Only with your consent.
Of working in a pool of sweat, a cautionary tale that I won't forget. It's blown my mind, this moral's tight.
Now's the time to set things right. Turn a new page from the sexist rage.
It just shouldn't happen in this day and age.
So next time I see a girl, I'll be true.
And if I'm feeling brave, I might try a guy too.
What?
Never mind. I feel like I've learned something.
Oh yeah? Well, do you want to apply what you've learned?
Not really. Not tonight, can't be bothered.
What do you want to do then?
Just want to have some fun. I got us a guitar solo.
Oh, how much?
£12.
Only with your consent. Only with your consent. Only with your consent.
This guy wants you, but
only with your consent. Only with your consent.
That's the Sex Consent Anthem by Jack Howard and Dean Dobbs, setting the mood for today's KPR Presents on Consent-Based Sex Education. I'm with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He's a licensed psychologist who specializes in teens and young adults and the co-author of the popular weekly column Double Take. As always, Wes, it's great to see you.
It is nice to be here, Kay.
I'm going to date myself here, but I remember my own sex education, both what I learned from my parents and in school, and the lesson was, besides the mechanics, the lesson was, wait till you're married. Period.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, of course, the standard abstinence model. And what is interesting about it is that any research done on this indicates that 95% of all adults living today had premarital sex. And you can...
Wait, say that again?
I knew you... 95% of all 95%. Of all people living today in America had sex outside of marriage. And that includes 70-year-old people and so on and so on. And we go back to the Puritans. Remember them? They were filled with abstinence. Most of them were pregnant when they got married.
What?
So, yeah, so this is somewhat of a mythology, and I was asked, I did a very conservative show, a religiously based show, a few years ago when the first books came out. And I was dreading the question. I knew it was coming. And it was really a good interview team. And she said to me, as a husband and wife, and she said to me, "So have you completely given up on abstinence?" And I said, "No, I just don't count on it anymore." And that, and it was funny because there was this pause, and she said, "Wow, I never thought of it that way before." And that's really all it is for people who really have a code they want to follow, a religious code or a personal code. I think that is a great decision. It's just a tiny minority, and instead we make our sex education, for political reasons, I think, aimed towards this tiny minority, and then ignore all of the other people who will be sexually active, 75% of them, by the time they are 19. What's interesting is we think of this as a fairly new cultural phenomenon, and the evidence is it just isn't. That 95% statistic suggests it isn't. But the thing for today, for young people today, that I think is important to understand, I will get questions on the air, in my office, in email. How do I know when my teen is sexually active? And you can see some pretty funny responses to that. I did a show in St. Louis, Great Day St. Louis. The woman interviewing me said, I always think I can smell it. And you can imagine the look I gave her on the air. And I said, "Well, there's an image." And this isn't really the way to go at it. The truth is, in high schools, there are kind of three groups, and people will see the statistics, and they're fairly cut and dried. And, you know, you have to assume in these statistics that people are telling the truth. I think that's probably not true. I think most of the research on teenagers about things that are not socially acceptable yield pretty inaccurate results.
Wait, so are you saying that teenagers underreport or overreport?
Yeah. I think they underreport. There was a study, I'll give you a good example, recent study out of Canada. You know, they do good research up there, those Canadians. And it said that 40%, that there had been an increase in boys using pornography. And that they had discovered that 40% of boys now reported, teenage boys, now reported using pornography. And this is just absurdly low. You ask any teenage girl, they'll tell you how many boys use pornography or have, and that, by the way, meant ever seen used pornography. That's just not something you're going to say yes to if an interviewer is sitting down or a document is given you. You're just not going to say yes. The drug literature is the same way. The drug tests that kids take, I hear them. They tell me, "Oh, we took the drug test this week, and oh my gosh." And everybody was laughing about it, and half the people said they'd used every drug in the world, and the other half said they'd never used a drug at all. And these are just not good ways to gather data. So if we start, let's just pretend it is and go with the statistics we have. And we know that about half of kids by age 16 have had vaginal sex. Then we know by the time they're 19, that goes up to about 75%. So what that ignores, the real problem with that, even if it's accurate, is it ignores the group of people who have not said they've had vaginal sex. And we have to say, well, now, okay, what's going on with that group? And what I see clinically, and you got to remember I've been at this for 22 years now, what I see is there is the group of kids who are having sex in high school, and there is the group of kids who want to be having sex in high school, but they aren't in the dating pool yet. And yes, then you have the small group, I've known them, worked with them, who are choosing, who are actively choosing not to be sexually active, and I am all for that. That's the essence of consent, is choosing to do what you mean to do. Well, if we assume instead that the half of the people at 16 who haven't had sex chose not to, we're deluding ourselves, and we're kind of insulating ourselves from a reality that makes us think, well, you know, my kid's probably in that group. If your child is in the dating pool, actively in the dating pool, you need to assume that there is a high, much higher than average likelihood that they are or will be sexually active. And if you accept that, with those exceptions of the abstinence code people, then you have to really respond to that with a clearer message, because if parents are not competing with the sexual messages in society right now, they are putting their kids at a dramatic disadvantage.
Well, let's talk about that competition that parents are under, or teachers who teach sex education. What kind of competition do they face in getting their message across?
This is what's so interesting. The legislature committee has been in Kansas has been trying to study the idea of making it a sex crime to put up certain posters about sexuality. And this is such a non-issue. Most of the discussion of abstinence education or comprehensive sex education is just really political. We need to all just accept comprehensive sex education, the true comprehensive sex education as defined in the literature, is never going to happen in schools.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. What exactly do you mean when you say comprehensive sex education?
That's a good question. So what we think that means as a society, when people say, well, we need to teach comprehensive sex education in the schools, we think that means learn to wear a condom, or, you know, talk about how to say no or something, or how to say yes. It's much broader than that. True comprehensive sex education, as represented, for example, by the Unitarian faith, they have a thing called OWL, Our Whole Lives. It stands for OWL. That's comprehensive sex education. They sit down and walk people through every aspect of sexuality, as well as relationship building, budgeting. I mean, it is comprehensive. I had a young person kind of walking me through the process about that the other day. They really take that seriously. That it's talking about being gay and lesbian and transgender. That's part of comprehensive sex education. These are all things that cannot happen in the schools. I don't know that I want them to happen in the schools, because I think that this is based on a lot of values that we need to teach as parents to our kids. So the basic mechanics are about all you're ever going to get. So that dialogue between these two sides is more political than it is practical. And thus, it falls back to us as parents to really figure out how to do this. And as we all know, that's not the easiest discussion for parents.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I have three children who are young adults. And while I feel pretty comfortable talking to them about sex, they are extremely uncomfortable listening to me talk about it or engaging in a conversation. How can you bridge that gulf of discomfort?
I think that's such a great point. And as just recently, we on our website, we have our consent-based sex education project. And one of the things that we did, Katie Gio, former co-author, and I did, was to commission a film by two teenagers in Florida that I found on Twitter. They are an actual dating couple. They're 16, and they have 41,000 followers on Instagram because people like to watch them being a couple. I like to watch them being a couple. I think it's delightful. You don't get to see enough of that. And they actually go do things together, which I think is neat. That's David and Nicole. So we had them shoot this film in which we had them ask teenagers about sex and sex education. And it's about a 7-minute film. And the teenagers do pretty good with the questions. Nicole told me that she was surprised how easily they responded to those questions. Guess what the question was that they fell apart on? The number one answer to this question was,
What was the question?
The question was, what would you tell your parents about teen sexuality? And the best answer, and it was by a wistful young woman who happens to be in a dating relationship. She's about 14 or 15. The best answer is that we got was, I would tell them it is not valued anymore. And that was moving and true and raw. But you will be surprised when you see the film how many people just couldn't answer the question. One of the girls actually says, well, I'd tell them that 50% of kids are having sex, which I don't know where she got that, but that's actually the right number for her age group. So kids, you're correct. It's what we seem to find is that even when parents get up the courage to have the conversation, they maybe haven't laid the foundation for that over the years in which they can really talk with kids, and the kids immediately respond with, oh yeah, this is the same thing as talking about the, you know, the Jayhawks or whatever it is we talk.
Okay, it's never going to be the same as talking about the Jayhawks.
It depends on how happy you are with the season. So, I think it really can be. The reason kids, we could go back and analyze your life, Kay, with your
kids. Oh, please, please let's not.
But ideally, if you start out young and you're talking about relationships, age-appropriate kinds of topics, and you sort of work your way up, it becomes a natural conversation. And I know parents and kids who absolutely can do that, and it's not an uncomfortable situation. We did a show a couple of years ago with Kendra Schwartz and her mother, and they had a very good conversation, as did her dad, with her about this topic, and it was just as textbook perfect as it could be. And the Schwartzes laid that foundation early in their lives, so that it really was like talking about the Jayhawks. Hey, there's baby Jay. Can we talk about contraception? It's just kind of a natural progression.
Okay, I'm so.
I just wish everyone could see Kay's face. But it's theater of the mind.
Just use your imagination. So young people today clearly have a much more casual approach to sexual relationships than perhaps we would like them to, or than we think we had in the past. What do you think are the long-term implications of that for us as a society?
Yeah, I think this is really the question before us right now. And it's super easy to be, you know, apocalyptic about everything. If you go back and read things that parents were saying about kids in the 20s or the turn of the century or the 50s or any of that, you know, they're all going straight down the tubes. So I always am trying to be very careful about that. But it's really, a lot of things are kind of irrefutable. Marriage, it's a tremendous irony that we're sitting around talking about gay marriage right now. The straight people don't want to get married at this age. They don't foresee that in a way that is different than it was 20 years ago. And kids, where this seems to come from, and we're just beginning to, I think, see the next turn of this, is that kids are kind of afraid of relationships. I've changed my thinking just this year on how to approach this, and we're going to have a column. We've had a column out now, I think, a week or two ago, where we talk about this idea that I'm kind of done with this. We're not going to put a label on it, or I don't want to be in a relationship or whatever. They're in a relationship. I'm telling kids right now, you are in a relationship with this person you're having sex with. You just don't have any rules set up. And what has happened in the dialogue is that just by saying we're not in a relationship makes it okay to not have any sense of obligation or ethics or rule system with each other. And that is really a problem. And young people are responding fairly well to this idea that I am coming across with now, that we just need to say, yes, talking is a relationship, especially if you're talking exclusively, which is part of the dating procedure now. And to say this isn't for real just because we aren't calling ourselves a couple or that it isn't important is just denying reality. And I think if we don't help kids think of relationships differently, they're going to have a really hard time down the road, because this is practice. This is how they're practicing for adulthood. And if it's, I don't want to put a label on it, 10 years down the road, we may wish they'll mature into that. But that's not what the trends historically have told us.
If we make the assumption that a teenage relationship or a young adult relationship is going to include a sexual relationship, does that make at least some young people much less willing to even enter the dating pool?
Well, this gets into the question of the people who are having sex and the people who want to be. There is a group of people who are reluctant and do not want to feel compelled to be sexually active just to be in the dating pool. And I'm with them. That isn't consent. We talk about in the book that there is it's more than no means no, and consent is, and it's more than yes means yes, that there's an idea of emotional consent. And this is, what do I mean to do? What is my choice? And today, if you are choosing to be abstinent, if you, for any reason, if you just simply want to put that off for a couple of years, or you want to be in a relationship that you see as exclusive and longer term before you're sexually active, which is my favorite, you know, way of looking at it too, then you may be taking yourself out of the dating pool. And there may have to be a conscious decision to really just be friends, not friends with benefits, but just friends with people during this period. I do know people who are doing that. And I don't count those amongst the abstinence-based people, because they are not saying, I'm not going to have sex someday. They're saying, I have a plan for this that I'm going to follow. And if parents can learn from those kids, and we'll be talking a lot about them in the book, then they have a better map, because consent requires there to be an authentic choice. And if you are the parent of a child who is legally of age to have sex, in this state that's 16 and 15 under the Romeo and Juliet statute, and you're trying to control that, you're trying to ground them if you catch them, or you're trying to prevent them from doing these things, one doesn't mean to do this, but what they're doing is conveying to the child the idea of an other orientation in who controls that child's sexuality. And the logical outgrowth of that, and I've seen it in young adults all the time, is to see your sexuality as controlled by the partner once you're out in the dating pool. And so parents want to be careful how much they're asserting this idea that they are in charge of their child's sexuality. It backfires in some ways that even I have been surprised to see.
Like, what do you mean?
People who then have a domineering partner. They date someone who basically follows the family model and says, your sexual expression belongs to me. And if you instead teach your child, well, I'll give you a good example. There's this thing called the feminist rules of dating my daughter out now. And it's a shirt. And I don't know that I can quote it perfectly, but it's based on this idea, this sort of down-home jokey t-shirt that says they'll shoot the person if they touch the daughter or something crazy. But this shirt says, the rules for dating my daughter, you don't make the rules. I don't make the rules. She makes the rules. And that is both pragmatic and a good way to approach things. Now, does that mean parents ought to just sit back and, you know, good luck, kids? No, not in the slightest. But if you become an advisor in that process, and the core question you have, which we're going to lay this all out in the book, is, are you doing what you mean to do? Are you intentional in your choices? Recognizing the authentic choice and really working to teach a child how to say yes to sex, which, everybody take a deep breath, it's not as bizarre as it sounds. We're teaching them how and when you might choose to have sex as a way of then giving them an authentic choice. And only when you know you have that choice can you really say no. Because a whole lot of kids go out and have sex because they were told no, or because they want to be in that dating pool, or because they think that's the socially correct thing to do.
Or they were being pressured into it.
Right. And what's funny is we all kind of have this idea that kids are pressured into sex. And I think that is a 1987 idea. It's much more complex than that. But few of us think of ourselves as parents pressuring our kids into sex. And the best thing you can do to pressure a kid into sex is tell them, you can't do that. And I wish I had a buck for every kid who's gone straight out just to say, I'm different than you are. I'm going to do what I want to do, and been regretful of it later. We would have a big old pizza in here. We would have so many piles of bucks, because it is a very common problem. And that's not consent. That's not emotional consent to just do the opposite of what somebody wants you to do.
Well, let's talk about consent-based education. What exactly does that mean for you as a parent or for you as a teacher?
Well, we have really come to this in parallel with a lot of other educators around the country, and the campuses are replete right now with concerns, this one and many others, with concerns about consent. And this is the most literal meaning of consent, is that people are saying, I've been sexually assaulted. And so that's the old no means no. Well, that just gets us about an inch into a 1,000-mile journey. Because the next line of that is only yes means yes. And of course, we support that idea too. This is the idea of enthusiastic consent, that you need to have someone who's clearly able to consent and who is happily doing so. But we see this going much further. It's become apparent to me it's a bigger issue than that. And that's this issue of emotional consent, the idea that kids are not thinking through that decision, in part to be rebellious, in part to join the crowd, in part to be a part of the dating pool. And my least favorite one of all, because they're super drunk, dating in late high school and college is as alcohol-fueled as an Indy race car. And
great analogy.
Yeah, and they have more wrecks than Indy, too. And this is throws everything into a mess. I can give many examples of young women who have not attained consent to be sexually active with a partner and have overtly done that to undercut the dating pool. And of course, I can give you terrible examples of young men who have overridden a partner's consent or not taken into account that she is not capable of consent and so on. So we know all of that, but we think it's got to start very young. Like the other day we were talking about this and somebody asked me, how do you teach this to young kids? And I said, you don't teach it as a sexual issue. You teach it in how people are involved with each other or their animals. Like we have cats. And if the cat, we have a thing where we say the cats are saying no, meaning they don't want to be held. And the cats give their consent or they don't. And we've done that since our kids were 3 years old. Or the idea that, you know, if kids don't want to be hugged, don't hug them. People have a hard time with that. And they think that's some sort of antisocial behavior. It isn't.
And how many times have you heard, oh, give Aunt Gladys a kiss when you know, your child doesn't want to give Aunt Gladys a kiss?
Exactly. And this is creating an other orientation about one's body. One of the best examples of this I ever have, and it's quite a story. I had a client who had this kind of mini boyfriend relationship in eighth grade. He was a couple years older than her, a year older than her, and went away to college. And she was a junior. And he came back to judge a forensics tournament and saw her sitting there in forensics. And he came over gleefully and threw his arms around her and was hanging side hug on her. Well, she doesn't like to be touched that way. She has some sensory issues. And she courageously asked him not to do that. And that, and I know from young women that takes a lot of courage. And he said, why not? She said, I just don't like to be touched that way. He said, well, did something happen to you as a child? She said, no. He says, well, there's just something wrong with that. She said, Wes, and she was crying by this time and telling me the story. And she said, I ended up in the bathroom sobbing. So I said to her, I don't quite understand, because I didn't at the time. And I said, you knew he wasn't trying to be sexual with you. You knew he wasn't trying to hurt you. What bothered you that much about it? And she said, I just felt like my no didn't count for anything. That is not a story about sex at all, but it sure is a story about consent. And what's tough in that story is she does everything right. She says no. She says she explains no. And young men have a tendency to be hurt when their friendship is rebuffed. And he defended his ego. He could have fixed that in 10 seconds and said, I am so sorry. I didn't realize that. Forgive me. And she'd have been his best friend. She'd have probably gone out with him. But he didn't. He started picking at her and trying to find out what's wrong with her that she doesn't want to be touched that way. And that's a metaphor for a lot of dating relationships. And we have to really teach kids at that level what consent is about and how to give it and when not to.
What advice do you give to young people about consent and how to assert their consent?
Really, the first thing you've got to do is to help them figure out what they mean to do. And on one hand, this seems obvious. And on the other hand, it seems kind of radical. Because if you're asking someone, okay, what do you really mean to do in this situation? You're saying the choice is up to you. And as we talked about earlier, that's hard for some parents to realize. Ultimately, they don't practically have control over a 15-year-old's body. What they can do, what we try to do in our office, is to get them thinking about that choice and saying, you know, it is an authentic choice. And the more that kids feel empowered to make the choice, the more likely the choice will be a wise one. Now, have I seen kids plow ahead and I've said, hey, is this what you really mean? And it's yes. I can see it in their eyes that it's not. But in the end, sometimes the learning that comes from that is more valuable long-term than just getting them not to do this thing. I've had many examples of that. So we talk about what is it you mean to do, and then once you are clear about that, you also want to be clear about it going into your encounter with somebody. The worst time to make a decision about whether you want to do something sexual with someone is in the middle of doing something sexual with someone. And not only does that get people's signals crossed up, it causes hurt feelings and it causes incidents to occur that people are then not satisfied with later. And so we talk about all of that. And communication, one of the good things that kids are doing right now is this whole thing we hear about talking. Talking is the new interview for the date. And you may be talking for months and then you're talking exclusively, which means you're only talking romantically to one person. And I like the idea behind this because it's a lot of it goes on over text messaging or now Snapchat, and people think that's terrible. Well, it really isn't. Getting to know somebody verbally or in written form has a long tradition in our country. People, and in our human civilization, people wrote to each other. And this forces people to actually ask some questions and to get to know each other. And it is a common question. It's almost 100% of the time someone, and it doesn't always have to be the guy, is going to say, are you going to have sex with me? And they're going to say that very early in the conversation. I know people who are asked that as the like calling card question. Are you a sexual person? Which is such a dumb question, because who isn't a sexual person? But in that discussion, they're asking, do I have a chance to have sex with you down the road? Now, that sounds pretty rude when you just hear it this way. But isn't it better to get it clear up front? That's really my main interest in you. And if that gives someone authentic choice to say, you know, you're going to have to wait and find out. Or I don't really reveal that information 5 minutes into our relationship. So the clarity of communication is a big part of consent. And it's also part of the next step in teaching kids is that you rarely have consent when alcohol is involved. And I don't mean they had a beer. That's not how anybody seems to drink around these parts. So the more alcohol that gets into these things, the less clear that choice can be and the less we do what we mean to do. And that's pretty much every day of the week in my office, some version of that story appears.
Wes, in developing this model of consent-based education, you've developed something that you call the PLUS model. What is that about?
Yes, we really came to understand that we were going to have to make this easy and accessible for parents. Having done this now and done media for several years, trying to come up with a way to communicate that.
You need an acronym.
You do. Everybody needs an acronym. And we also realized we were going to have to script things out for people so they could really just read the script and put themselves into it. So that's something else we're working on. But all of those scripts are based on this PLUS model. And it stands for pause, listen, understand, and be sex positive. And the pause is harder to achieve than you think because we're using this PLUS model in response to what we call difficult teen situations, particularly sexual situations. And so today, those situations are many and varied. Historically, it's been you found out they were having sex. Well, that's just one of a myriad of possibilities. The child may come out as gay or transgendered or lesbian. They may be using online explicit content, pornography, which is a heavy amount of use nowadays. You may find them posting sexually explicit pictures, whether those are what we would call beach pictures or whether they're more so than that. We've seen more of this. So these kinds of difficult situations are kind of new. They're not something we were looking at when we were younger. And so the PLUS model works with all of these things. And the first thing you have to do is really take a big old deep breath. And if you can't say something constructive in response to these situations, by all means, graciously excuse yourself and go pull it together.
A variation on the, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all.
Exactly.
Just distance yourself for a minute.
Well, and I'd even say nice isn't necessarily it. It's constructive, because there may be good reasons. If your child is posting his or her parts, nude parts, on the internet, there's not a lot nice to say about that. But there are some constructive things to say about it, and you've got to figure out what those are before you say anything. The less you say, the less you have to take back. And it's very easy. One of the things we must understand in working with our kids that I have come to understand now doing more work with adults around sexual issues is it is easy to do harm sexually to your kid by saying surprisingly few things, and that sticks with the kid and creates sexual dysfunction later in their life. So the problem isn't just keep your kid from having sex or don't get pregnant. Those could be important issues. But it's also, how do I want to support this kid's development sexually? And so you want to pause and think through, how is this going to come across? And then the listen, the L is listen, and that's kind of self-explanatory, but it's active listening. You're saying, okay, so help me understand why pornography is interesting to you, and or what does it mean to you to be pansexual? I thought I'd throw a new term at you.
I've heard that one before.
Good, so. Yeah. That's one that may pop up quite a bit. So listen to what the young person has to say. Then understand the you isn't just understanding them. It's understanding yourself. You've got to really step back and think, why is this triggering me? Now, catching your child in bed with a partner in your house at 3:30 in the morning, it's pretty easy to understand why you're upset. But once you get done with the pause and the listen and think about, what's really my biggest worry here? What is happening to me? Am I embarrassed? Am I scared? Do I feel like a bad parent? What's happening? So it's self-understanding as well as understanding the child.
And then that last letter, S?
Sex positive. And again, that means, it doesn't mean anything goes and, you know, let's all buy our kids 50 Shades of Grey. Don't worry, if they're girls, they've already read it. It means to say, okay, I'm not going to judge your choice here or your personhood, but I'm just wanting to know, did you mean to do that? And you've got to have had a good dialogue with the kid to have that discussion. But honestly, Kay, in my office, where people talk to me about things they don't talk to anybody else about half the time when I say, did you mean to do that? The answer is no. I had a young person I saw recently who told me, I actually don't know most of the people I've had sex with. And I said, I believe you. She said, no, you don't understand. I don't know who they were. That's how much alcohol consumption had been in her. She hadn't had sex sober. So she didn't mean to do any of that. And we had to have some pretty deep conversation about how she got to that point. So that's really the core question at sex positive. She's had plenty of sex. I don't think she would say it was positive. So that's the PLUS model. And we're going to build off of that to really teach how to interact with kids around all of those scenarios and more.
I'm wondering if part of the reason as parents we're so devoted to this abstinence-only model is because that's what we were taught. And you just hit on something really important, and that's that things have changed pretty rapidly just within the last couple of years in terms of education and how we try to educate and express values as well as information to our kids.
Yes, it's a huge change. And I think it's interesting you bring this up too, that we're really in the age group of people who were brought up in a post-sexual revolution era. And you would think that we would really kind of have gotten it together, because I agree that the abstinence model has been with us always. But likewise, there were landmark books written in the early 70s.
Our Bodies, Ourselves.
That's which one of them.
I think everybody I knew in college had that book.
Absolutely. And then there were books like Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, but Were Afraid to Ask. This was a number one bestseller because it did exactly what the title said. And so yet we have not done a very good job of advancing what was a more enlightened view in our young days to the next generation. And part of what has changed so rapidly is absolutely the internet. The reason that the subtitle of this book is Parenting Teens in an Internet Age is because the internet is the watershed moment, and it brings tremendous good to kids. They are able to get on there and learn some really good facts and information and decisional models for sexuality, and they are able to get on there and see the most extreme sexual content imaginable. And it would take us approximately 4 seconds, were we to go to clicking right now, to get onto that material. Material that makes 50 Shades of Grey look like something for kindergartners. Kids have this, they see it, many of them use it. Many young people expect that kind of behavior in sexual relationships now. And if we're back in the birds and the bees era, somebody asked me the other day, whatever happened to the birds and the bees? And I said, I think that was 1927. We have to really craft a message that responds with an understanding of what kids are exposed to. And if we're worried about a poster in a high school or even what's on HBO right now, we're not realizing what kids are tapped into.
Let me follow up on that comment that you just made about 50 Shades of Grey and what kids are exposed to. How do you think material like that and the expectation that this is, I'm using air quotes here, normal sexual behavior, mm-hmm. how does that affect our young women and young men?
Okay, so we're going to have to go on another 2.5 hours.
Okay, the short version.
Let me give you the short version. So the first thing one has to sort of let go of is this idea of normal, because normal in any sexological study is whatever falls under the bell curve. And what is portrayed in 50 Shades, and I only know this because I have a friend who's friends with the author, so that she's briefed me on the whole book, because no man in North America has ever read it. That's not very unusual sexual behavior at this point. What is bad and what's problematic in the book, why the people who are practitioners of that kind of sexual relationship do not like the book, is because there is no evidence of consent in the book. There's apparently a scene where he violates the safe word, and she uses the safe word, and he doesn't abide by it. And this is the sin of greatest sin in that community. So that's the first little thing you have to kind of understand. But in terms of how teenagers consume any of this material, the problem lies in that they are, regardless of their perceived sophistication, new consumers. They are people who are just being tossed into the toy store and looking around and seeing all these bright, shiny objects. And what they're seeing is this kind of content. And so they adopt the idea that anything is open. And young men, particularly at this point, are making requests of young women. And I will say that it certainly goes the other way around, believe me, that are portrayed in online video content. Whether that's designed really to work well at this age, many of those things require tremendous partnership and understanding of each other and their bodies, and this is not something kids are necessarily trained to do. So that's why it's a problem, is kids aren't really prepared well to respond to a lot of that material. Now, when you say that to them, they go like this. That's the sound. So they're not open to that discussion until you say to them, I'm not going to be judgy about this, you know, that I'm not going to tell you it isn't normal to want to do some of these things. And once you can get into that kind of sex positive discussion, then you can say, I'm not sure you meant to do this. Tell me how you did. And there are more stories I can tell than are allowed on the air about how that can play out.
Wes, by your own record, you've logged 24,000 hours of face-to-face counseling with young people. How have your own views changed over the years and years that you have experience?
Well, I need more naps now. it's a lot of hours. No, I'm kidding. It is very interesting. It is like my undergraduate degree is in sociology, political science, and history. And so this is like a journey of watching the evolution of a culture from where it was in 1994 to where it is in 2015. And it, in one sense, it's great because kids are talking openly about these issues. When I started out, it just wasn't that common to have this kind of dialogue. Things were going on and they would pop up and be a surprise. Today, that level of openness is helpful because it gives us an opening to really discuss these kinds of issues. That's been great. The downside of it is that I don't think we have evolved. That's not fair. Parents have evolved in one area, and very specifically, parents are much better today at dealing with contraception. And teenagers, specifically teenage girls, frankly, are better at contraception. This is why the pregnancy rate is dramatically reduced. I had 4 pregnant teenage girls on my caseload at one time in 1997. And that has never happened again, and it's rare at this point. So that has evolved, in fairness. In other areas, we haven't kept pace with these changes. And so that's what I've kind of seen, is the world changes more rapidly than the adults can hang on to it.
One of the big changes that I know I've seen over the last couple decades is society's views of gays, lesbians, transgender, especially among young people. How does that figure into this equation?
It's a big change. I don't know if it's a symptom or a driving force, to be honest with you, but it is the next big thing, and has been really for the last couple of 3 years. Today, just in the time it's taken for one class of students to move through high school, it is considered in most communities extremely offensive to bully or mistreat a person who is in the queer community. That is wrong. And I have so many amusing stories of people like getting together and retaliating against the bully. That I don't want to say that's a passé issue now, but it's just not where we're at. It's much more socially interesting to say that you are bisexual or pansexual or gay or lesbian or transgendered. It's way more interesting to come out in that way now than it is to be mean to those people. And so I think that has been a great change for folks. Now, I'm sure there are listeners who think that's the end of the civilization as we know it. This is an area that still is contentious. But for the under 30 crowd, it isn't contentious anymore. This is just, these are our friends and our dating partners, and I think we're headed more and more in that direction. So that's been a big change, because one cannot make an assumption anymore that their child is just clearly heterosexual. There is an openness now that allows people to make more of a decision about that than just to be kind of automatically assigned who you are.
How does that figure into consent-based education? That yes means yes, regardless of your orientation.
It's quite a significant point. Historically, the GBLTQ community has adhered, people in my age group and down to about the 25-year-olds, has really adhered to this idea that this is kind of preordained. And I understand where that came from, and I'm not going to dispute it, but I know people as adolescents and young adults who are saying, this is fluid for me.
You mean sexual orientation?
Sexual orientation, okay. Even gender orientation. I think one of the best, and some people will hate this and some people will love it. I think one of the best answers the other day. I now ask every young person, how do you identify, gay, straight, you name it? And one young person of 18 years of age said to me the other day, you know, I'm not sure I'm old enough to have figured that out yet. And I think that's a great answer. On one hand, that does reinforce this idea of going through a stage. And boy, that's the worst thing. That's not one of the things we suggest you say to your child if she or he comes out as gay is, well, maybe you're going through a stage. But at the same time, this person recognized, I am in the process of figuring this out to myself about how I identify. And that's why that term is now the common term. How do you identify? So we're moving away from an era where this is preordained and into an era where people are exploring and figuring out how they fit. And, you know, we may see that the majority of people continue on to be very straight, very vanilla folks. And that's just A-okay. But we're much more accepting now for those who are finding a different path.
It's a rapidly changing world out there. How can we help parents who are over 30 years old and not part of this age bracket? How can we help them adjust to what they need to know to help their kids?
Yes, if your child is 15 and you're 30, you were a very young parent. And those do exist, but the majority of people who have teenagers are over that age. And so this, as we know from the statistics, the further you get from 30 in the wrong direction, the more you are going to have a hard time with this. And we see this, I'm kind of surprised actually at how often I see parents with a gay or lesbian or pansexual, et cetera, a teenager or young adult come in and they're kind of already handling it pretty well. I've had a few really tough ones, but a lot of times this coming out process is much less dramatic than it has been in the past. Nevertheless, the best thing we can do for parents, in my view, is to prepare them for a wide variety of contingencies. That's kind of the goal in the book. We're going to hopefully do some videos, too, that really illustrate this plus model so that parents can go in front of the mirror or driving to work in the morning or whatever they need to do and just talk to themselves and kind of walk through, okay, my child comes to me and says, I'm gay. Big breath. How am I going to respond?
How do I want to respond?
Right. And you do this ahead of time. Do it when they're 10 or something. Had a fifth grader the other day disclose to the family that this individual was gay. We're seeing this earlier than you think. How am I going to respond to that? And really suggest to parents, maybe you won't have to deal with that issue, or maybe your kid won't ever be interested in pornography or any of these things, and you won't have to worry about it. But it's better that you think about it as if it could happen, because sure as shooting, one of those scenarios is going to appear if it's nothing other than I am sexually active or am planning to be. And I'll tell you what, the best thing I ever see, honestly, in this issue is when a parent comes in and the child has come to them and said, I am planning to be sexually active. I want to go and be on birth control or whatever. That parent may feel like they have failed or something, but they are a successful parent because they have a child who has faith in them to know the plus model without ever having seen it.
Dr. Wes, it's always great to talk to you.
Well, it's always fun to be here. You are just one of my favorite interviewers. You always have such good things to talk about.
Thank you so much. Dr. Wes, before I let you go, if people want to find out more, especially parents want to find out more, what resources do you have for them?
We are very interested in this topic right now, and so our website is full of programs we've done for 4 years. Our Kickstarter is there. Our Plus model is there. I have a little slideshow. All of that you can find at drwes.com. It's dr-wes.com. A person could sit there for hours listening to all the stuff we have online.
And we're looking forward to your forthcoming consent-based sex education book. Any idea how soon that will be out?
We would hope to have it out in the fall. That is the plan right now, at least the paperback form, and then we'll have an audiobook and Kindle and hardcover. We really have done well in the library sales this year with I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, so we definitely want to have that market available.
Let's talk about that book for just a minute. You were on this show last year talking about your previous book, I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. How are things going with that book?
Great. We have been so happy. It's the audiobook has done better than I ever imagined. I think people with ADD like audiobooks because it is the number one selling a book about ADHD on audible.com and has been for a number of weeks, and the top-rated audiobook about ADHD on Amazon. But if you don't like audiobooks, there's a paperback and a Kindle, too, and it's done very well. We've had wonderful exposure across the country, and it's gone better than we ever could have expected.
And just a disclaimer, I read the foreword for that audiobook.
I didn't know if you were going to tell, and I'm pretty sure that your foreword is why it has sold so well. I'm sure of it.
Again, Wes Crenshaw, it's great to talk to you.
Good to be
here. For the rest of this hour, the story of a Kansas City doctor who rose from a hardscrabble childhood to become a pioneer in the field of heart surgery. Along with his wife, Dr. William Reed is the namesake of the Cardiovascular Surgery Center at the University of Kansas Medical Center. He was on the team that performed the first open-heart surgery at KU Med back in the 1950s. Dr. Reed has just written The Pulse of Hope, A Surgeon's Memoirs from Poverty to Prosperity. He joins us by telephone from his home in Kansas City, Missouri. Dr. Reed, thank you for joining me today.
So nice to be with you, Kay.
You became a cardiologist in the 1950s when heart surgery was still in its earliest days. Tell me about your decision to specialize in cardiac surgery and what it was like to be in the field in the 1950s.
Cardiac surgery was developing at that time, and it the thing that it changed it completely was the development of ways to maintaining the body's vital functions while working with the heart stopped and working inside the heart. And so the heart-lung machines were being developed at that time. That brought together then a team of people that some of whom would run the heart-lung machine and the technology that goes with that, and then the various repair procedures, the valve replacements and repairing of congenital heart problems developed in the 50s. So it was a dynamic, changing, challenging, risky, exciting time in cardiac surgery.
Dr. Reed, let me jump forward a couple decades. In 1985, you performed the first heart transplant at St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City. Tell me about that.
Well, that was one of the most exciting times. I think that it was a patient that had been in heart failure and had previous heart operations done. There is nothing that is like the experience of taking a patient who is in really critical situation and taking out the heart of that person and then putting a donor heart in and then watch the donor heart hesitate for a moment. And you're hoping and praying that it starts, and then to watch it start and take over and say, I can do this for this new person, and the wonderful gift it is from one person to another. It's the height of what we do together. It's not just myself, but it's everyone in the room. And that night we got back into the intensive care at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And there were a number of the referring physician, the family was there a bit later, but the people in the intensive care there was just a spontaneous applause out of the feeling of having done this and having the patient coming into the intensive care doing well. So it's a life-changing experience. It was for me.
I've been visiting with Dr. William A. Reed. He's the author of The Pulse of Hope, A Surgeon's Memoirs from Poverty to Prosperity. Dr. Reed, thank you so much for visiting with me today.
Thank you so much for calling, Kay.
The KU Bookstore is hosting a reading and book signing by Dr. William Reed on Thursday, April 30th in the Kansas Union. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.